This is Audible.
Audio Renaissance presents New Spring by Robert Jordan. Read for you by Kate Redding and Michael Kramer.
Chapter 1. The Hook. A cold wind gusted through the night across the snow-covered land where men have been killing one another for the past 3 days. The air was crisp, if not so icy as Lan expected for this time of year. It was still cold enough for his steel breastplate to carry the chill through his coat, and his breath to mist in front of his face when the wind did not whip it away. The blackness in the sky was just beginning to fade, the thousands of stars, like the thick scattered dust of diamonds, slowly dimming. The fat sickle of the moon hung low, giving barely light to make out the silhouettes of the men guarding the fireless camp in the sprawling copse of oak and leatherleaf. Fires would have given them away to the Aiel. He had fought the Aiel long before this war began, on the Shinaran marches, a matter of duty to friends. Aiel men were bad enough in daylight. Facing them in the night was as close to staking your life on the toss of a coin as made no difference. Of course, sometimes they found you without fires. Resting a gauntleted hand on his sword in its scabbard, he pulled his cloak back around himself and continued his round of the sentries through calf-deep snow. It was an ancient sword, made with the One Power before the breaking of the world, during the War of the Shadow, when the Dark One had touched the world for a time. Only legends remained of that age, except perhaps for what the Aes Sedai might know, yet the blade was hard fact. It could not be broken, and never needed sharpening. The hilt had been replaced countless times over the long centuries, but not even tarnish could touch the blade. Once, it had been the sword of Malkyrie kings. The next sentry he came to, a short stocky fellow in a long dark cloak, was leaning back against the trunk of a heavy-limbed oak, his head slumped on his chest. Lan touched the sentry's shoulder, and the man jerked upright, almost dropping the horn and sinew horsebow gripped in his gloved hands. The hood of his cloak slid back, revealing his conical steel helmet for an instant, before he hastily pulled the cowl up again. In the pale moonlight, Lan could not make out the man's face behind the vertical bars of his face guard, but he knew him. Lan's own helmet was open in the style of dead Malkyr, supporting a steel crescent moon above his forehead.
"I wasn't sleeping, my lord," the fellow said quickly. "Just resting a moment."
A copper-skinned Domani, he sounded embarrassed, and rightly so. This was not his first battle, or even his first war.
"An Aiel would have wakened you by slitting your throat, or putting a spear through your heart, Basram," Lan said in a quiet voice.
Men listened closer to calm tones than to the loudest shouts, so long as firmness and certainty accompanied the calm.
"Maybe it will be better without the temptation of the tree so near."
He refrained from adding that even if the Aiel did not kill him, the man risked frostbite standing in one place too long. Basram knew that. Winters were nearly as cold in Arad Doman as in the borderlands. Mumbling an apology, the Domani respectfully touched his helmet and moved 3 paces out from the tree. He held himself erect now and peered into the darkness. He shifted his feet, too, guarding against blackened toes. Rumor said Aes Sedai were offering healing closer to the river, injuries and sickness gone as if they had never been. But without that, amputation was the usual way to stop a man losing his feet to black rot, and maybe his legs as well. In any case, it was best to avoid becoming involved with Aes Sedai more than absolutely necessary. Years later, you could find one of them had tied strings to you just in case you might have need. Aes Sedai thought far ahead, and seldom seemed to care who they used in their schemes or how. That was one reason Lan avoided them. How long would Basram's renewed alertness last? Lan wished he had the answer, but there was no point in taking the Domani to task further. All of the men he commanded were bone-weary. Like every man in the army of the grandly named Great Coalition, sometimes it was called the Grand Coalition, or the Grand Alliance, or half a dozen other things, some worse than uncomplimentary. Likely every last man was near exhaustion. A battle was hot work, snow or no snow, and tiring. Muscles could not from tension even when they had the chance to stop for a time. and the last few days had offered small chance to stop very long. The camp held well over 300 men, a full quarter of them on guard at any given time. Against Aiel, Lan wanted as many eyes as he could manage. And before he had gone another 200 paces, he had had to wake three more, one asleep on his feet without any support at all. JM's head was up and his eyes open. That was a trick some soldiers learned, especially old soldiers like JM. Cutting off the gray-bearded man's protests that he could not have been asleep, not standing up straight, Lan promised to let JM's friends know if he found him sleeping again. JM's mouth hung open for a moment, then he swallowed hard.
"Won't happen again, my lord. The lights sear my soul if it does."
He sounded sincere to his bones. Some men would have been afraid that their friends would rub them senseless for putting the rest in danger, but given the company JM kept, more likely he dreaded the humiliation of having been caught. As Lan walked on, he found himself chuckling. He seldom laughed, and it was a fool thing to laugh over, but laughter was better than worrying over what he could not change, such as weary men drowsing on guard. As well worry about death. What could not be changed must be endured. Abruptly, he stopped and raised his voice.
"Bukama, why are you sneaking about? You've been following me since I woke."
A startled grunt came from behind him. Doubtless Bukama had thought he was being silent, and in truth, very few men would have heard the faint crunching of his boots in the snow. Yet he should have known Lan would. After all, he had been one of Lan's teachers, and one of the first lessons had been to be aware of his surroundings at all times, even in his sleep. Not an easy lesson for a boy to learn, but only the dead could afford oblivion. The oblivious soon became the dead, in the blight beyond the borderlands.
"I've been watching your back,"
Bukama announced gruffly, striding up to join him.
"One of those black-veiled Aiel dark friends could sneak in and cut your throat for all the care you're taking. Have you forgotten everything I taught you?"
Bluff and broad, Bukama was almost as tall as he, taller than most men, and wearing a Malkieri helmet without a crest, though he had the right to one. He had more concern for his duties than his rights, which was proper, but Lan wished he would not spurn his rights so completely. When the nation of Malkier died, 20 men had been given the task of carrying the infant Lan Mandragoran to safety. Only 5 had survived that journey, to raise Lan from the cradle and train him, and Bukama was the last left alive. His hair was solid gray now, worn cut at the shoulder as tradition required, but his back was straight, his arms hard, his blue eyes clear and keen. Tradition infused Bukama. A thin braided leather cord held his hair back, resting in the permanent groove across his forehead it had made over the years. Few men still wore the Hadori. Lan did. He would die wearing it, and go into the ground wearing that and nothing else, if there was anyone to bury him where he died. He glanced north toward his distant home. Most people would have thought it a strange place to call home, but he had felt the pull of it ever since he came south.
"I remembered enough to hear you," he replied.
There was too little light to make out Bukama's weathered face, yet he knew it wore a glower. He could not recall seeing any other expression from his friend and teacher, even when he spoke praise. Bukama was steel, clothed in flesh. Steel his will, duty his soul.
"Do you still believe the Aiel are pledged to the Dark One?"
The other man made a sign to ward off evil, as if Lan had spoken the Dark One's true name, Shaitan. They had both seen the misfortune that followed speaking that name aloud, and Bukama was one of those who believed that merely thinking it drew the Dark One's attention. "The Dark One and all the Forsaken are bound in Sheol Ghul," Lan recited the catechism in his head. "Bound by the Creator at the moment of creation. May we shelter safe beneath the light in the Creator's hand." He did not believe thinking that name was enough, but better safe than sorry when it came to the shadow.
"If they aren't, then why are we here?"
Bukama said sourly. And surprisingly. He liked to grumble, but always about inconsequential things or prospects for the future, never the present.
"I gave my word to stay until the end," Lan replied mildly.
Bukama scrubbed at his nose. His grunt might have been abashed this time. It was hard to be sure. Another of his lessons had been that a man's word must be as good as an oath sworn beneath the light, or it was no good at all. The Aiel had indeed seemed like a horde of dark friends when they suddenly spilled across the immense mountain range called the Spine of the World. They had burned the great city of Kyrian, ravaged the nation of Kyrian, and, in the 2 years since, had fought through Tyr, and then Andor before reaching these killing fields outside the huge island city of Tarvalen. In all the years since the nations of the present day had been carved out of Arthur Hawkwing's empire, the Aiel had never before left the desert called the Waste. They might have invaded before that, no one could be sure, except maybe the Aes Sedai and Tarvalen, but as so often with the women of the White Tower, they were not saying. What Aes Sedai knew, they held close, and doled out by dribbles and drops when and if they chose. In the world outside of Tarvalen, though, many men had claimed to see a pattern. 1,000 years had passed between the breaking of the world and the Trolloc Wars, or so most historians said. Those wars had destroyed the nations that existed then, and no one doubted that the Dark One's hand had been behind them, imprisoned or not, as surely as it had been behind the War of the Shadow, and the Breaking, and the end of the Age of Legends. 1,000 years from the Trolloc Wars until Hawkwing built an empire, and that too was destroyed after his death, in the War of the 100 Years. Some historians said they saw the Dark One's hand in that war too. And now, close enough to 1,000 years after Hawkwing's empire died, the Aiel came, burning and killing. It had to be a pattern. Surely the Dark One must have directed them. Lan would never have come south if he had not believed that. He no longer did, but he had given his word. He wriggled his toes in his turned-down boots. Whether or not it was as cold as he was used to, iciness burrowed into your feet if you stood too long in one place in snow. "Let's walk," he said. "I don't doubt I'll have to wake 12 more men, if not 2, and make another round to wake others." Before they could take a step, however, a sound brought them up short and alert, the sound of a horse walking in the snow. Lan's hand drifted to his sword hilt, half-consciously easing the blade in its sheath. A faint rasp of steel on leather came from Bukama doing the same. Neither feared an attack. Aiel rode only at great need, and reluctantly even then. But a lone horseman at this hour had to be a messenger, and messengers rarely brought good news these days, especially not in the night. Horse and rider materialized out of the darkness following a lean man afoot, one of the sentries by the horsebow he carried. The horse had the arched neck of good Tyran bloodstock, and the rider was plainly from Tyr as well. For one thing, the scent of roses came ahead of him on the wind, from the oils glistening on his pointed beard, and only Tyrans were fool enough to wear scent, as if the Aiel had no noses. Besides, no one else wore those helmets, with a high ridge across the top and a rim that cast the man's narrow face in shadow. A single short white plume on the helmet marked him an officer, an odd choice for a messenger, albeit an officer of low rank. He huddled in his high-cantled saddle and held his dark cloak tightly around him. He seemed to be shivering. Tyr lay far to the south. On the coast of Tyr, it never snowed so much as a single flake. Lan had never quite believed that, whatever he had read, until he had seen it for himself.
"Here he is, my lord," the sentry said in a hoarse voice.
A grizzled Saldaean named Rakim. He had received that voice 1 year back, along with a ragged scar that he liked to show off when drinking, from an Aiel arrow in the throat. Rakim considered himself lucky to be alive, and he was. Unfortunately, he also believed that having cheated death once, he would continue to do so. He took chances, and even when not drinking, he boasted about his luck, a fool thing to do. There was no point to taunting fate.
"Lord Mandragoran."
The rider drew rein in front of Lan and Bukama. Remaining in his saddle, he eyed them uncertainly, no doubt because their armor was unadorned, their coats and cloaks plain wool and somewhat worn. A little embroidery was a fine thing, but some southern men decked themselves out like tapestries. Likely under his cloak, the Tyran wore a gilded breastplate and a silk satin coat striped in his house colors. His high boots were certainly embroidered in scrollwork that shone in the moonlight with the glitter of silver. In any case, the man went on with barely a pause for breath.
"The light burned my soul. I was sure you were the closest, but I was beginning to think I'd never find you. Lord Imoris is following about 500 or 600 Aiel with 600 of his armsmen."
He shook his head slightly.
"Odd thing is, they're heading east, away from the river. At any rate, the snow slows them as much as it does us, and Lord Imoris thinks if you can place an anvil on that ridgeline they call the Hook, he can take them from behind with a hammer. Lord Imoris doubts they can reach it before first light."
Lan's mouth tightened. Some of these Southlanders had peculiar notions of polite behavior. Not dismounting before he spoke, not naming himself. As a guest, he should have named himself first. Now Lan could not withhold sounding boastful. The fellow had failed to even offer his lord's compliments or good wishes, and he seemed to think that they did not know that east would be away from the River Aranin. Perhaps that was just carelessness in speech, but the rest was rudeness. Bukama had not moved, yet Lan laid a hand on his sword arm anyway. His oldest friend could be touchy. The Hook lay a good league from the camp, and the night was failing, but he nodded.
"Inform Lord Imoris that I will be there by first light," he told the horseman. The name Imoris was unfamiliar, but the army was so large, near 200,000 men representing more than a dozen nations, plus tower guards from Tarvalin, and even a contingent of the Children of the Light, that it was impossible to know above a handful of names.
"Bukama, rouse the men."
Bukama grunted, savagely this time, and with a gesture for Rakim to follow, stalked away into the camp, his voice rising as he went.
"Wake and saddle! We ride! Wake and saddle!"
"Ride hard," the nameless tyrant said, with at least a hint of command in his voice. "Lord Imoris would regret riding against those Aiel without an anvil in place."
He seemed to be implying that Lan would regret this Imoris's regretting. Lan formed the image of a flame in his mind and fed emotion into it, not anger alone, but everything, every scrap, until it seemed that he floated in emptiness. After years of practice, achieving Kodi, the oneness, needed less than a heartbeat. Thought and his own body grew distant, but in this state he became one with the ground beneath his feet, one with the night, with the sword he would not use on this mannerless fool.
"I said that I would be there," he said levelly. "What I say, I do."
He no longer wished to know the man's name.
The tyrant offered him a curt bow from his saddle, turned his horse, and booted the animal to a quick trot.
Lan held the Kodi a moment longer to be sure his emotions were firmly under control. It was beyond unwise to enter battle angry. Anger narrowed the vision and made for foolish choices. How had that fellow managed to stay alive this long? In the borderlands, he would have sparked a dozen duels in a day. Only when Lan was sure that he was calm, almost as cool as if he were still wrapped in the oneness, did he turn. Summoning the tyrant's shadowed face brought no anger with it. Good. By the time he reached the center of the camp among the trees, it would have seemed a kicked ant-heap to most men. To one who knew, it was ordered activity and almost silent. No wasted motion or breath. There were no tents to be struck, since pack animals would have been an encumbrance when it came to fighting. Some men were already on their horses, breastplates buckled in place, helmets on their heads, and in their hands, lances tipped with a foot or more of steel. Nearly all of the rest were tightening saddle girths or fastening leather-cased horse bows and full quivers behind the tall cantles of their saddles. The slow had died in the first year fighting the Aiel. Most now were Saldaeans and Kandori, the rest Domani. Some Malkieri had come south, but Lan would not lead them, not even here. Bukama rode with him, but he did not follow. Bukama met him carrying a lance and leading his yellow-roan gelding Sun Lance, followed by a beardless youth named Caniadrin, who was carefully leading Lan's cat dancer. The bay stallion was only half-trained, but Caniadrin was well advised to take care. Even a half-trained warhorse was a formidable weapon. Of course, the Kandori was not as innocent as his fresh face suggested. An efficient and experienced soldier, an archer of rare skill, he was a cheerful killer who often laughed while he fought. He was smiling now, at the prospect of fighting to come. Cat Dancer tossed his head, also impatient. Whatever Caniadron's experience, Lan checked Cat Dancer's saddle girths carefully before taking the reins. A loose girth could kill as quickly as a spear thrust.
"I told them what we're about this morning," Bukama muttered after Caniadron had headed off to his own mount. "But with these Aiel, an anvil can turn into a pincushion if the hammer is slow in coming."
He never grumbled in front of the men, just to Lan.
"And the hammer can become a pincushion if it strikes with no anvil in place," Lan replied, swinging into the saddle.
The sky was plainly gray now. Still a dark gray, but only a scattered handful of stars remained.
"We will have to ride hard to reach the hook before first light."
He raised his voice.
"Mount!"
Ride hard they did, cantering half a mile, then trotting, then leading the animals by the reins at a fast walk before mounting to begin over. In stories, men galloped for 10 miles, 20. But even without snow, to gallop the whole 4 or 5 miles would have lamed half the horses and winded the rest long before reaching the hook. The silence of the fading night was broken only by the crunch of hooves or boots in the snow crust, the creak of saddle leather, and sometimes the muttered curses of men who caught a toe on a hidden stone. No one wasted breath on complaints or talk. They had all done this often, and men and horses hit an easy rhythm that covered ground quickly. The land around Tarvalen was rolling plain for the most part, dotted with widely spaced copses and thickets, few large, but all thick with darkness. Large or small, Lan eyed those clumps of trees carefully as he led his men past, and he kept the column well away. Aiel were very good at using whatever cover they could find, places where most men would be sure a dog could not hide, and very good at springing ambushes. Nothing stirred, though. For all his eyes could see, the band he led could have been the only living men in the world. The hoot of an owl was the only sound he heard that they did not make. The sky in the east was a much paler gray by the time the low ridge called the Hook came into sight. Well under a mile in length, the treeless crest rose little more than 40 feet above the surrounding ground, but any elevation gave some advantage in defense. The name came from the way the northern end curved back toward the south, a feature plainly visible as he arranged his men in a long line along the top of the ridge to either side of him. The light was definitely growing. To the west, he thought he could make out the pale bulk of the White Tower itself, rising in the center of Tarvalen, some 3 leagues distant. The tower was the tallest structure in the known world, yet it was overshadowed by the bulk of the lone mountain that rose out of the plains beyond the city, on the other side of the river. That was clear enough when there was any light at all. In the deepest night, you could see it blocking the stars. Dragon Mount would have been a giant in the spine of the world, but there on the plain it was monstrous, piercing the clouds and rising taller. Higher above the clouds than most mountains were below, its broken peak always emitted a streamer of smoke. A symbol of hope and despair, a mountain of prophecy. Glancing at it, Bukama made another sign against evil. No one wanted that prophecy fulfilled, but it would be, of course, one day. From the ridgeline, gentle rolling ground ran more than a mile to the west, to one of the larger thickets, half a league wide. 3 trampled paths crisscrossed the snow between, where large numbers of horses or men afoot had passed. Without going closer, it was impossible to say who had made them, Aiel or men of the so-called Coalition, only that they had been made since the snowfall stopped, late 2 days ago. There was no sign of Aiel yet, but if they had not changed direction, which was always possible, they could appear out of those trees any moment. Without waiting for Lan's order, men drove their lances point down into the ground beneath the snow, where they could be snatched up again easily at need. Uncasing their horse bows, they pulled arrows from their quivers and knocked them, but did not draw. Only newlings thought they could hold a drawn bow for long. Lan alone carried no bow. His duty was to direct the fight, not to select targets. The bow was the preferred weapon against the Aiel, though many Southlanders disdained it. Imares and his Tyrans would ride straight into the Aiel with their lances and swords. There were times when that was the only way, but it was foolish to lose men needlessly before you must, and as surely as peaches were poison, you did lose men in close quarters with Aiel. He had no fear that the Aiel would turn aside on seeing them. They were not wild fighters, no matter what some said. They refused battle when the odds were too great. But 600 Aiel would see the numbers as just right. They would be facing fewer than 400, although placed on the high ground. They would rush forward to attack and be met with a hail of arrows. A good horsebow could kill a man at 300 paces and wound at 4, if the man drawing it had the skill. That was a long corridor of steel for the Aiel to run. Unfortunately, they carried bows made of horn and sinew too, just as effective as the horsebows. The worst would be if the Aiel stood and exchanged arrows. Both sides would lose men, however quickly Imaris arrived. Best would be if the Aiel decided to close. A running man could not shoot a bow with any accuracy. At least it would be best if Imaris was not behind time. Then the Aiel might try for the flanks, especially if they knew they were being followed, and that would kick open the hornet's nest. Either way, when Imaris struck them from the rear, Lan would gather the lances and ride down. In essence, that was the hammer and anvil. One force to hold the Aiel in place until the other struck it, then both closing in. A simple tactic, but effective. Most effective tactics were simple. Even the pig-headed Kyrianen had learned to use it. A good many Altarans and Mirandians had died because they refused to learn. Grayness welled into light. The sun would be peeking over the horizon behind them soon, silhouetting them on the ridge. The wind gusted, catching Lan's cloak, but he assumed the Kodi once more and ignored the cold. He could hear Bukama and the other men near him breathing. Along the line, horses stamped their hooves impatiently in the snow. A hawk quartered above the open ground, hunting along the edge of the wide thicket. Suddenly the hawk wheeled away and a column of Aiel appeared, coming out of the trees at a quick trot, 20 men abreast. The snow did not appear to hamper them to any great degree. Lifting their knees high, they moved as quickly as most men would have on cleared ground. Lan pulled his looking glass from the leather case tied to his saddle. It was a good glass, Kyrianen made, and when he pressed the brass-bound tube to his eyes, the Aiel, still a mile off, seemed to leap closer. They were tall men, many as tall as he, and some taller, wearing coats and breeches in shades of brown and gray that stood out against the snow. Each had a cloth wrapped around his head and a dark veil hiding his face to the eyes. Some might be women. Aiel women sometimes fought alongside the men, but most would be men. Each carried a short spear tipped in one hand, with a round bullhide buckler and several more spears clutched in the other. Their bows were in cases on their backs. They could do deadly work with those spears, and their bows. The Aiel would have had to be blind to miss the horsemen waiting on them, but they came on without a pause, their column a thick serpent sliding out of the trees toward the ridge. Far to the west a trumpet sounded, thin with distance, and then another. To be that faint, they had to be near to the river, or even on the other side. The Aiel kept coming. A third trumpet called, far off, and a fourth, a fifth, more. Among the Aiel, heads swung, looking back. Was it the trumpets drew their attention, or did they know Imaris was following? The Aiel continued to issue from the trees. Someone had miscounted badly, or else more Aiel had joined the first party. Over 1,000 were clear of the trees now, and still more came. 1,500, and more behind. He slid the looking glass back into its case. "Embrace death," Bukama muttered, sounding like cold steel, and Lan heard other borderlanders echo the words. He merely thought them. It was enough. Death came for every man eventually, and seldom where or when he expected. Of course, some men died in their beds, but from boyhood, Lan had known he would not. Calmly, he looked left and right along the line of his men. The Saldaeans and Kandori were standing firm, of course, but he was pleased to see that none of the Domani showed any signs of edginess either. No one looked over his shoulder for a path to run. Not that he expected any less after 2 years fighting alongside them, but he always had more trust of men from the borderlands than elsewhere. Bordermen knew that sometimes hard choices had to be made. It was in their bones. The last of the Aiel cleared the trees, easily 2,000 of them, a number that changed everything and nothing. 2,000 Aiel were enough to overrun his men and still deal with Imaris, unless the Dark One's own luck was with them. The thought of withdrawing never arose. If Imaris struck without the anvil in place, the Tyrans would be slaughtered. But if he could hold until Imaris arrived, then both hammer and anvil might be able to draw clear. Besides, he had given his word. Still, he did not mean to die here to no purpose, nor to have his men die to none. If Imaris failed to arrive by the time the Aiel came inside 200 paces, he would wheel his company off the ridge and try to ride around the Aiel to join the Tyran. Sliding his sword from its scabbard, he held it loosely at his side. It was just a sword now, with nothing about it to catch the eye or set it out. It would never again be anything except a sword. But it held his past and his future. The trumpets to the west were sounding almost continuously. Abruptly, one of the Aiel in the front of the column raised his spear overhead, holding it up for the length of 3 strides. When he brought it down, the column came to a halt. A good 500 paces separated them from the ridgeline, well beyond bowshot. Why, under the light? As soon as they were halted, the rear half of the column turned to face the way they had come. Were they simply being cautious? Safer to assume they knew about Imaris. Drawing out his looking glass again, left-handed, he studied the Aiel. Men in the front rank were shading their eyes with their spear hands, studying the horsemen on the ridge. It made no sense. At best, they would be able to make out dark shapes against the sunrise, perhaps the crest on a helmet. No more than that. The Aielmen seemed to be talking to each other. One of the men in the lead suddenly raised his hand overhead, holding a spear, and others did the same. Lan lowered his looking glass. All of the Aiel were facing forward now, and every one held a spear raised high. He had never seen anything like this before. As one, the spears came down, and the Aiel shouted a single word that boomed clearly across the space between, drowning the trumpet's distant calls.
On a line!
Lan exchanged wondering glances with Bukama. That was the old tongue, the language that had been spoken in the Age of Legends, and in the centuries before the Trolloc Wars. The best translation Lan could come up with was, one man alone. But what did it mean? Why would the Aiel shout such a thing?
They're moving, Bukama muttered.
And the Aiel were. But not toward the ridge. Turning northward, the column of veiled Aiel quickly reached a trot again, and, once the head of it was well beyond the end of the ridge, began to angle eastward once more. Madness piled on madness. This was no flanking maneuver, not only on one side.
Maybe they're going back to the waste, Caniadrin called.
He sounded disappointed. Other voices scoffed him loudly. The general view was that the Aiel would never leave until they were all killed.
Do we follow? Bukama asked quietly.
After a moment, Lan shook his head.
We will find Lord Imaris and talk. Politely, concerning hammers and anvils, he said.
He wanted to find out what all those trumpets were about, too. This day was beginning strangely, and he had the feeling there would be more oddities before it was done.
Chapter 2. A Wish Fulfilled. Despite a fire blazing on the green marble hearth, the Ammerlin's sitting room was cold enough to make Moiraine shiver, and only a tight jaw kept her teeth from chattering. Of course, it also stopped her from yawning, which never would have done, half a night's sleep or not. The colorful winter tapestries hanging on the walls, bright scenes of spring and garden parks, ought to have had a coating of frost, and icicles should have been hanging from the scroll-carved cornices. For one thing, the fireplace lay on the other side of the room from her, and its warmth did not extend far. For another, the tall glassed casements behind her, filling the arched windows that led onto the balcony overlooking the Ammerlin's private garden, did not fit as well as they might, and they leaked cold around the edges. Whenever the wind gusted outside, an icy breeze hit her back and cut through her woolen dress. Another struck her closest friend as well, but for all that Swan was Tyran, she would not have let it show if she were freezing to death. The Sun Palace in Kyrian, where Moiraine had done most of her growing up, had often been as cold in winter, yet there she had never been forced to stand in draughts. The chill seeped from the marble floor tiles through the flowered Ilianer carpet, and Moiraine's slippers, too. The golden great serpent ring on her left hand, the snake biting its own tail that symbolized eternity and continuity and an initiate's bond to the tower, felt like a band of ice. When the Ammerlin told an accepted to stand over there and not bother her, however, the accepted stood where the Ammerlin pointed and tried not to let her notice any shivers. Worse than the cold, really, was the heavy smell of acrid smoke that even the heavy drafts could not dispel. It was not the smoke of chimneys, but of burned villages around Tar Valon. Concentration on the cold kept her from fretting over the smoke and the battle. The sky outside the windows held the gray of early morning now. Soon the fighting would begin again, if it had not already. She wanted to know how the battle was going. She had a right to know. Her uncle had started this war. She certainly did not excuse the Aiel in the slightest for the destruction they had brought to Kyrian, city and nation, but she knew where the ultimate blame lay. Since the Aiel arrived, though, accepted had been confined to the tower grounds as strictly as novices. The world outside the walls might as well have ceased to exist. Reports came at regular intervals from Azil Marid, high captain of the tower guard, but the contents were not shared with anyone except full sisters, if with them. Questions about the fighting addressed to Aes Sedai earned admonitions to concentrate on your studies, as though the largest battle fought since Arthur Hawkwing's time, and practically under her nose, was a mere distraction. Moiré knew she could not be involved in any meaningful way, not in any way, really, yet she wanted to be, if only by knowing what was happening. That might be illogical, but then she had never thought she was going to join the White Aja once she gained the shawl. The two silk-gowned women in shades of blue, seated on opposite sides of the small writing table on one side of the room, gave no sign that they were aware of the smoke or the cold, though they were almost as far from the fireplace as she. Of course, they were Aes Sedai, with ageless faces, and for the smoke, they had certainly seen the aftermath of more battles than any general. They could remain serenity-made flesh if 1,000 villages burned right in front of them. No one became Aes Sedai without learning to control her emotions at need, inwardly and outwardly. Tamra and Gitara did not seem tired, though they had taken only catnaps since the fighting began. That was why they had accepted in attendance all night, in case they wanted errands run or someone brought to them. As for the cold, neither cold nor heat touched sisters the way it did other people. They always appeared unaware of either. Moiraine had tried to work out how that was done. Every accepted tried sooner or later. However it was worked, it did not involve the One Power, or she would have been able to see the weaves, or at least feel them. Tamra was more than simply Aes Sedai. She was the Ammerlin Seat, the ruler over all Aes Sedai. She had been raised from the blue, but of course the long stole draped on her shoulders was striped in the colors of the 7 Ajahs, to show that the Ammerlin was of all Ajahs and none. Over the history of the tower, some Ammerlins had taken that more literally than others. Tamra's skirts were slashed with all 7 colors, though that was not required. No Aja could feel itself advantaged or disadvantaged with her. Beyond the tower, when Tamra Ospenya spoke, kings and queens listened, whether they had Aes Sedai advisers or hated the White Tower. That was the power of an Ammerlin Seat. They might not take her advice or obey her instructions, but they listened, and politely. Even the High Lords of Tyr and the Lord Captain Commander of the Children of the Light did that much. Her long hair, lightly streaked with gray and caught in a jeweled silver net, framed a square, determined face. She usually got her way with rulers, but she did not take her power lightly or use it indiscriminately, either outside the tower or inside. Tamra was fair and just, which were not always the same thing, and she was often kind. Moiraine admired her greatly. The other woman, Tamra's keeper of the chronicles, was a different matter altogether. Perhaps the second most powerful woman in the tower, and certainly at least equal to the sitters, Gitara Moroso was always just and usually fair, but kindness never seemed to occur to her. She was also flamboyant enough for a green or a yellow. Tall and close to voluptuous, she wore a wide necklace of fire drops, earrings with rubies the size of pigeons' eggs, and 3 jeweled rings beside her great serpent ring. Her dress was a deeper blue than Tamra's and brocaded, and the keeper's stole on her shoulders, blue, since she also had been raised from the blue, was nearly wide enough to be called a shawl. Moraine had heard that Gitara still considered herself a blue, which would be shocking if true. The width of her stole certainly spoke in favor of the whispers. That was a matter of personal choice. As with all Aes Sedai, once they had worked long enough with the One Power, it was impossible to put an age to Gitara's face. At a glance, you might think she was no more than 25, perhaps less. Then a second glance would say a youthful 45 or 50, and still just short of great beauty, while a third changed it all again. That smooth, ageless face was the mark of Aes Sedai, to those who knew. To those who did not know, and many did not, her hair would have added to the confusion. Caught with carved ivory combs, it was white as snow. By whispered rumor, she was over 300 years old, very old even for an Aes Sedai. Speaking of a sister's age was extremely rude. Even another sister would be given a penance for it. A novice or accepted would find herself sent to the mistress of novices for a switching. But surely thinking about it did not count. Something else placed Gitara out of the ordinary. She had the foretelling sometimes, the talent of speaking what was still in the future. That was a very rare talent, and came to her only occasionally, but gossip, the accepted's quarters overflowed with tittle-tattle, gossip said that Gitara had had more than one foretelling in the last few months. Some claimed that the reason the armies outside the city had been in place when the Aiel came was one of Gitara's foretellings. No one among the accepted knew for certain, of course. Maybe some of the other sisters did. Maybe. Even when the fact that Gitara had had a foretelling was common knowledge, sometimes no one other than Tamra learned what it had been. It was foolish to hope to be present when Gitara had a foretelling, yet Moraine had hoped. But in the 4 hours since she and Swan had replaced Tamila and Brendas in attendance on the Ammerlin, Gitara had only sat there writing a letter. It suddenly hit her that close on 4 hours was a very long time to spend on one letter, and Gitara had not covered half of one sheet of paper yet. She was sitting there with her pen suspended above the cream-colored page. As if Moraine, thinking of it, had somehow reached her, Gitara glanced at the nib and made a small sound of irritation, then swirled the steel nib in a small red-glazed bowl of alcohol to clean away dried ink, clearly not for the first time. The liquid in the bowl was as black as that in the silver-capped ink jar of cut glass on the table. A gilt-edged leather folder full of papers lay open in front of Tamra, and she appeared to be studying them intently, yet Moraine could not remember seeing the Ammerlin turn over a single sheet. The two Aes Sedai's faces were images of cool calm, but plainly they were worried, and that made her worried, too. She bit at her lower lip in furious thought, then had to stop when a yawn threatened. The biting, not the thinking. It had to be something to make them worry today in particular. She had seen Tamra in the corridors yesterday, and if there had ever been a woman bubbling with confidence, it had been she. So, the battle that had been raging for the last 3 days. If Gitara really had foretold the battle, if she really had had other foretellings, what else might they have been? Guessing would do no good, but reasoning might. The Aiel crossing the bridges and breaking into the city? Impossible. In 3,000 years, while nations rose and fell and even Hawkwing's empire was swept away in fire and chaos, no army had managed to breach Tarvalin's walls or break down its gates, and quite a few had tried over that time. Perhaps the battle turning to disaster in some other way. Or something needed to avoid disaster? Tamra and Gitara were the only two Aes Sedai actually in the tower at that moment, unless some had returned in the night. There had been talk of injured soldiers in such numbers that all sisters with the smallest ability at healing were needed, but no one had said straight out that that was where they were going. Aes Sedai could not lie, yet they often spoke obliquely, and they were not above misdirection. Sisters also could use the power as a weapon if they or their warders were in danger. No Aes Sedai had taken part in a battle since the Trolloc Wars, when they faced Shadowspawn and armies of Dark Friends, but perhaps Katara had foretold disaster unless Aes Sedai joined. But why wait until the third day? Could a foretelling be that detailed? Maybe if the sisters had entered the battle earlier, that would have caused... Out of the corner of her eye, Moiraine saw Swan smiling at her. That smile turned Swan's face from handsome to pretty and made her clear blue eyes twinkle. Nearly a hand taller than Moiraine, Moiraine had gotten over the irritation she had once felt at being shorter than nearly all the women around her, but she could never help noticing height. Taller and almost as fair-skinned as she, Swan wore her formal acceptance dress with an air of assurance that Moiraine had never quite mastered. The high-necked dresses were the purest white except for the bands at hem and cuffs that copied the Amerlin's seven-colored stole. She could not understand how so many sisters of the White Aja could bear to wear white all the time, as if they were forever in mourning. For her, the hardest thing about being a novice had been dressing in plain white day after day. The hardest aside from learning to control her temper, anyway. That still dropped her in hot water now and then, but not so often as during her first year.
"We'll find out when we find out," Swan whispered with a quick glance at Tamra and Gitara.
Neither moved an inch. Gitara's pen was held over the letter again, the ink drying. Moiraine could not help smiling back. Swan had that gift, making her smile when she wanted to frown and laugh when she wanted to weep. The smile turned into a yawn, and she looked hastily to see whether the Amerlin or the Keeper had noticed. They were still absorbed in their own thoughts. When she turned back, Swan had a hand over her own mouth and was glaring at her over it, which almost set her giggling. It had surprised her at first, she and Swan becoming friends. But among novices and accepted, the closest friends always seemed to be very much alike or very different. In some things, she and Swan were alike. They were both orphans. Their mothers had died while they were young, their fathers since they left home. And both had been born with the spark, which was uncommon. They would have begun channeling the power eventually, whether or not they had tried to learn how. Not every woman could learn, by any means. That was where the differences began, before they arrived in Tar Valon, and it was not just that Swan had been born poor and she wealthy. In Kyrian, Aes Sedai were respected, and Moiraine had been given a grand dance in the Sun Palace to celebrate her departure for the Tower. In Tyr, channeling was outlawed, and Aes Sedai were not popular. Swan had been bundled onto a ship bound upriver for Tar Valon the very day a sister discovered she could learn to channel. There were so many differences, though none mattered between them. Among other things, Swan had come to the Tower in full control of her temper. She was quick with puzzles, which Moiraine was not. She could not abide horses, which Moiraine loved. And she learned at a rate that left Moiraine dazed. Oh, not about channeling the one power. They had been entered in the novice book on the same day and moved almost in lockstep with the power, even to passing for accepted on the same day. Moiraine, though, had received the education expected of a noblewoman, everything from history to the old tongue, which she spoke and read well enough that she'd been excused classes in it. The daughter of a Tyran fisherman, Swan arrived barely able to read or do more than the simplest arithmetic, but she had soaked her lessons in like sand soaking up water. She taught the old tongue to novices now, at least the beginning classes. Swan Sanche was held up to novices as an example of what they should aspire to. Well, both of them were. Only one other woman had ever finished novice training in just 3 years. Elida Aroihan, a detestable woman, had completed her time as accepted in 3 years too, also a record, and it seemed at least possible that they might match that as well. Moiraine was all too aware of her own shortcomings, but she thought that Swan would make a perfect Aes Sedai. She opened her mouth to whisper that patience was for stones, but wind rattled the casements and another blast of freezing air hit her.
She might as well have been standing in her shift for all the protection her dress gave. Instead of whispering, she gasped, loudly. Tamra turned her head toward the windows, yet not because of Moiraine. The sound of distant trumpets suddenly was floating on the wind, dozens of them. No, hundreds. To be heard here inside the tower, there would have to be hundreds. And the sound was continuous, call rolling over call. Whatever the cause, it must be urgent. The Amaryllin closed the folder lying before her with a slap. "Go see if there's news from the battlefield, Moiraine." Tamra spoke almost normally, but her voice held an unidentifiable edge, a sharpness. "Swan, make some tea. Quickly, child." Moiraine blinked. The Amaryllin was worried, but there was only one thing to do. "It will be as you say, Mother," she and Swan said together without hesitation, offering deep curtsies, and turned for the door to the anteroom, beside the fireplace. The gold-chased silver teapot sat on a rope-work tray on a table near that door, along with a tea canister, a honey jar, a small pitcher of milk, and a large pitcher of water, all in worked silver. A second tray held cups made of delicate green seafolk porcelain. Moiraine felt a faint tingle as Swan opened herself to the source and embraced Sidar, the female half of the power. A glow surrounded her, though it would be visible only to another woman who could channel. Normally, channeling to do chores was forbidden, yet the Amaryllin had said quickly. Swan was already preparing a thin thread of fire to bring the tea water to a boil. Neither Tamra nor Gitara spoke a word to stop her. The anteroom to the Amaryllin's apartments was not large, since it was only meant to hold a few visitors until they could be announced. Delegations came to the Amaryllin in one of the audience halls, or in her study next door, not her private chambers. Backed by the sitting room fireplace, the anteroom was almost warm. There was only one chair, simply carved but large, yet despite its weight, the chair had been dragged closer to one of the gilded stand lamps, so Ellen Worrell, the slender novice on duty, would have better light to read. Facing away from the sitting room door and intent on her wood-bound book, she did not hear Moiraine cross the fringed carpet. Ellen should have felt her presence long before she was close enough to peer over the child's shoulder. Not really a child, since she had been 7 years a novice and had come to the tower at 18, but a novice was referred to as a child no matter her age. For that matter, Aes Sedai called accepted child, too. Moiraine had been able to feel the child's ability to channel soon after entering the room. Ellen certainly should have been able to sense hers from this near. One woman who could channel could never sneak up on another if the second was paying attention. Peering over Ellen's shoulder, she recognized the book instantly. Hearts of Flame, a collection of love stories. The Tower Library was the largest in the known world, containing copies of almost every book that had ever been printed, but this was unsuitable for a novice. Accepted were granted a little leeway. By that time you knew that you would watch a husband age and die, and your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, while you changed not at all. But novices were quietly discouraged from thinking about men or love, and kept away from men entirely. It would never do for a novice to try running away to get married, or worse, to get herself with child. Novice training was purposefully hard. If you were going to break, better it happened as a novice than as a sister. Being Aes Sedai was truly hard, and adding a child to it would only make matters beyond difficult. "You should find more appropriate reading, Ellen," Moiraine said levelly, "and pay more attention to your duties." Before Moiraine finished speaking, Ellen leaped to her feet with a startled gasp, the book tumbling to the floor, and whirled around. She was not tall for an Andoran, but Moiraine still had to look up to meet her eyes. When she saw Moiraine, she heaved a small sigh of relief. Very small. To novices, accepted were only a tiny step below Aes Sedai. Ellen spread her plain white skirts in a hasty curtsy. "No one could have come in without my seeing, Moiraine. Marianne Sedai said I could read." She tilted her head to one side, toying with the wide white ribbon that held her hair. Everything novices wore was white, even their thin leather slippers. Why is that book inappropriate, Moiraine? She was 3 years the elder, but the great serpent ring and banded skirts marked a fount of knowledge in novice eyes. Unfortunately, there were subjects Moiraine felt uncomfortable talking about with just anyone. There was such a thing as decorum. Picking up the volume, she handed it to the novice. The librarians would be very put out if you returned one of their books in damaged condition. She felt a measure of satisfaction at that. It was the sort of reply a full sister might have given when she did not want to answer the question. Accepted practiced the Aes Sedai way of speaking against the day they gained the shawl, but the only ones to practice on safely were the novices. Some tried it with the servants, for a little while, but that only got them laughed at. Servants knew very well that in Aes Sedai eyes, accepted were not a small step below the sisters, but a small step above the novices. As hoped for, Ellen anxiously began examining the book for damage, and Moiraine went on before the novice could come back to her embarrassing question. "Have there been any messages from the field of battle, child?" Ellen's eyes widened indignantly. "You know I'd have brought it in right away if there'd been any message, Moiraine. You know I would." She did know. Tamra had known, too. But while the keeper or a sitter might point out that the Amarlin had given a foolish order, at least she thought they might, and accepted could only obey. For that matter, novices were not supposed to point out that an accepted had asked a foolish question. "Is that the proper way to answer, Ellen?" "No, Moiraine," Ellen said contritely, bobbing another curtsy. "There hasn't been any message the whole time I've been here." Her head tilted again. "Did Gitara Sedai have a foretelling?" "Go back to your reading, child." As soon as the words were out of her mouth, Moiraine knew they were wrong, contradicting what she had said before. It was too late for a recovery now, though. Turning quickly and hoping that Ellen had not noticed the blush suddenly heating her face, she glided out of the anteroom with as much dignity as she could muster. Well, the mistress of novices had told the child she could read, and the librarians had let her take the book, if one of the accepted had not loaned it to her. But Moiraine did hate sounding like a fool. A faint trickle of steam was rising from the teapot's spout and more from the water pitcher when Moiraine re-entered the sitting room and closed the door. The glow of Saidar no longer shone around Swan. Water boiled very quickly when the one power was used. The trick was to keep it all from flashing to steam. Swan had filled two of the green cups and was stirring honey into one. The other was milky. Swan pushed the cup she had been stirring toward Moiraine. "Gitara's," she said softly, and then in a whisper with a grimace, "she likes enough honey to turn it to syrup. She told me not to be stingy." The porcelain was just barely too hot on Moiraine's fingertips, but it should be cooled to exactly the right point by the time she crossed the room to the writing table where Gitara still sat, now drumming her fingers on the tabletop impatiently. The polished blackwood clock on the mantel over the fireplace chimed first rise. The trumpets were still calling. They seemed to sound frantic, though Moiraine knew that was only imagination. Tamra was standing at the windows, peering out at a sky that was growing brighter by the moment. She continued to stare out after Swan had curtsied and proffered her cup, then finally turned and saw Moiraine. Instead of taking the tea, she said, "What news, Moiraine? You know better than to delay." Oh, she was on edge, to speak so. She had to know Moiraine would have spoken immediately if there had been anything. Moiraine was just offering Gitara her own cup, but before she could reply, the keeper jerked to her feet, bumping the table so hard that the ink jar overturned, spreading a pool of black across the tabletop. Trembling, she stood with her arms rigid at her sides, and stared over the top of Moiraine's head, wide-eyed with terror. It was terror, plain and simple. "He is born again," Gitara cried. "I feel him. The dragon takes his first breath on the slope of Dragon Mount. He is coming. He is coming. Light help us. Light help the world. He lies in the snow and cries like the thunder. He burns like the sun." With the last word, she gasped,
a tiny sound, and fell forward into Moiraine's arms. Moiraine dropped the teacup to try to catch her, but the truth of it was that the larger woman bore both of them to the carpet. It was all Moiraine could do to end up on her knees holding the keeper, rather than lying beneath her. In an instant, Tamra was there, kneeling careless of the ink trickling from the table. The light of Sidar already surrounded her, and she already had a weave prepared of spirit, air, and water. Gripping Gitara's head between her hands, she let the weave sink into the still form. But delving, used to check health, did not turn to healing. Looking helplessly into Gitara's staring eyes, Moiraine knew why not. She had hoped there was some tiny fragment of life left, something that Tamra could work with. Healing could cure any sickness, mend any injury, but you could not heal death. The pool of ink on the table had spread to ruin whatever the keeper had been writing. It was very odd what you noticed at a time like this. "Not now, Kitara," Tamra breathed softly. She sounded weary to the bone. "Not now, when I need you most." Slowly her eyes came up to meet Moiraine's, and Moiraine started back on her knees. It was said Tamra's stare could make a stone move, and at that moment Moiraine believed. The Armerlin shifted her gaze to Swan, still standing in front of the windows. Swan had both hands pressed to her mouth, and the teacup she had been carrying lay on the carpet at her feet. She gave a jerk under that gaze, too. Moiraine's eye found the cup she had been carrying. A good thing the cups did not break, she thought. Sea folk porcelain is quite expensive. Oh, the mind did play odd tricks when you wanted to avoid thinking about something. "You are both intelligent," Tamra said finally, "and not deaf, unfortunately. You know what Gitara just foretold?" There was just enough question in that for both of them to nod and say that they did. Tamra sighed, as if she had been wishing for a different response. Taking Gitara out of Moiraine's arms, the Armerlin eased her down to the carpet and smoothed her hair. After a moment, she pulled the wide blue stole from Gitara's shoulders, folded it carefully, and laid it over the keeper's face. "With your permission, Mother," Swan said in a husky voice, "I'll send Ellen to fetch the keeper's serving woman to do what's needful."
"Stay,"
Tamra barked. That iron-hard gaze studied them both.
"You will tell no one about this. Not for any reason. If necessary, lie, even to a sister. Gitara died without speaking. Do you understand me?"
Moiraine nodded jerkily and was aware of Swan doing the same. They were not Aes Sedai yet. They still could lie, and some did occasionally, for all their efforts to behave like full sisters. But she had never been expected to be ordered to, especially not to Aes Sedai, and never by the Armerlin.